I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Chris Moore, a partner at Cleary Gottlieb in the San Francisco Bay Area. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, David.
We're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First of all, a little bit about you and your background, then your view of Silicon Valley in the months and years ahead, the realities of a more challenging financing market and what that means for M&A, the effect of more aggressive antitrust oversight in Washington on how M&A lawyers are drafting and negotiating their deals, then a little bit about ChatGPT and how it and the emerging AI technology may affect the practice of M&A. And then finally, a little bit about what you do to decompress from work. So with that, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to have the practice you do.
Sure. So I guess I'll start by giving a shout out to my hometown. I grew up in a suburb of Los Angeles called San Dimas, which is where the cult classic movie Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure took place. I don't know if you've seen that, David.
Oh, it's a great one. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm still shocked by how many people know San Dimas because of that movie. I'm the son of a public school teacher and a screw salesman, so there were no lawyers in my family. I went to college at UCLA, and since we're in the middle of March Madness, I'll just go ahead and volunteer that, yes, I picked UCLA to go all the way this year, and I really hope they don't let me down. As I was finishing up my last year at UCLA, I started an internship working for the governor of California, which I was really excited about.
And who was the governor at that point? Was it Schwarzenegger?
It was the governator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, indeed. So he was a really interesting character, but after a few months in the job, I realized that politics just really wasn't my thing. So I asked some of my colleagues in the governor's office for career advice, and the most common answer was actually a question. It was, why don't you go to law school? So that's what I did. Having spent my entire life up to that point in Southern California, I decided to try something different, and I actually accepted a job in New York at a Wall Street law firm. I moved across the country after I graduated law school in 2008, and I started my legal career right in the middle of the collapse of Lehman Brothers.
And literally, you were on the subway the Monday morning that Lehman filed for bankruptcy, correct? Ready to go to your first day as a practicing lawyer.
That's correct. I was not reading the news. I was really focused on my first day as a lawyer, very nervous. I was almost, you know, completely oblivious about what was going on in the outside world. And as I was walking up the stairs from the subway, there was this, you know, rush of people carrying things in boxes. And I was like, that's weird, but I'm not going to worry about that right now. So, yeah, it was a scary time, and I felt incredibly fortunate to have any job, let alone a job where I could work on deals that were on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. I had the opportunity to work on a variety of different transactions as a junior lawyer, but after I closed my second M&A deal, I had one of those light bulb moments, and I caught the M&A bug. And while I love living in New York, I always knew I would move back to California at some point. I eventually ended up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And for the last 10 years or so, my practice is focused on representing large tech companies in M&A and shareholder activism matters.
Did you find any difference between your practice, albeit as a junior lawyer in New York, with that client base and a much more tech-focused client base in the Bay Area?
So I would say the quality of the lawyering is just as good. I do think that there's great lawyers all over the place. The difference is that I think the tech companies are focused on different issues, and they really want their lawyers to understand their business and really understand tech. There's a huge focus on talent retention and on equity awards and on obviously IP issues. And to be an M&A lawyer, you know, who represents tech companies regularly, you have to be conversant in those areas or you're just not going to be credible. And if you were sort of a generalist sitting in New York, I think it would be much more difficult for you to have a basic conversation about what revesting is and why that matters. And so I think we've seen the progression over many years of lawyers becoming more and more specialized, and a lot of M&A lawyers in particular focus on specific industries. Then being in the Bay Area, and the fact that there's just so many large companies in the tech sector who are doing really complicated transactions, you know, my natural home was focusing on tech.
And so what's your view of the outlook for the Valley now in a period where obviously we've been in an M&A drought for at least the last year? And in the last week, we've seen the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and the challenges that First Republic and Signature are facing.
Yeah, maybe let's start with Silicon Valley Bank, because that's at the top of mind for a lot of people. And funny enough, until recently, I think many people outside of the Bay Area had never even heard of Silicon Valley Bank. But to really understand the SVB saga, we probably should do a quick history lesson.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. So starting in the spring of 2020, you know, the pandemic was raging. Governments around the world are flooding their economies with stimulus, and central banks, including our own Federal Reserve, were reducing interest rates to zero or near zero. So in other words, money was as close to free as it has ever been. At the same time, tech companies were pursuing scale to match the extreme demand growth they experienced during the pandemic because everyone was working from home. That all changed once inflation started to take hold, because markets began to internalize, you know, the expectations of a high interest rate environment. So they began valuing short-term cash flow over growth. Basically, everything that those companies had been doing for years was no longer seen as valuable in the market. And so higher interest rates have had a number of knock-on effects. You know, some of them have been direct, some of them have been indirect, but it started with widespread layoffs in the tech sector as the market sentiment changed. And over the last, you know, 9 months or so, IPO activity has kind of come to a virtual halt. So that was followed by the collapse of FTX, along with the price of most cryptocurrencies. And then there were more layoffs. And now there's the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. So kind of a long stream of bad news, unfortunately. But with that context, I think let's go into what happened with SVB. And maybe we should just start with, what did SVB do? Why should anybody care if you're focused on tech or Silicon Valley?
Well, and SVB also had a very robust business providing, you could almost call them back office financial services to a number of prominent private equity firms in addition to VC firms.
That's right. Yeah. And I think a lot of people are focusing on the venture funds and the startups, but you're right. They had a very large role in an ecosystem. You know, they're a bank that participates in credit facilities for a lot of tech-focused sponsors like Vistas and Thoma Bravos of the world. But I think the thing that really distinguished Silicon Valley Bank from other banks is that it, you know, offered banking services to startups that often weren't profitable and sometimes didn't even have a product. You know, venture firms also bank with SVB and encourage their portfolio companies to do the same. But I think the most underappreciated point is that SVB was firmly embedded in the startup ecosystem and was known for hosting events where founders could connect with future co-founders, future partners, customers, investors, et cetera. And in a relationship-driven place like Silicon Valley, that had real value. So when the Fed began raising interest rates to fight inflation, startup capital dried up. And as I mentioned, you know, IPOs basically came to a halt. And since startups are no longer replenishing their bank accounts with new venture funding, there was a sudden reversal in deposit flows, and SVB was forced to sell assets to meet customers' liquidity needs. Unfortunately for SVB, it was doing something that in 2008 would have been viewed as very safe and practical. It was investing in treasuries and long-dated government-backed securities. But the problem was, as interest rates went up, the value of the assets it had to sell continued to drop with each interest rate hike. And SVB didn't hedge that interest rate risk, and so it had to take really big losses when it sold the bonds. That eventually sparked fears about SVB's solvency, leading to, I think it was $42 billion in withdrawals in a single day. And I think right. That's one of the largest bank runs in U.S. history. So I think the velocity of SVB's demise was shocking to a lot of people, and we're still feeling the reverberations today.
Well, I don't think anyone knows how long those reverberations will last. And I guess given your comments at the beginning of the podcast about starting your career literally on the day Lehman collapsed, how do you compare these two events?
Well, it's still early, and I think we're seeing a lot of things developing in real time. When Lehman collapsed, it felt like the world was ending. It touched off a global financial crisis. And I think it was felt a lot on Main Street, as not only on Wall Street. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, the fact that all the depositors are going to be made whole, and also in the case of Signature Bank, same thing. We didn't have the cash crunch type situation, and companies were able to make payroll, and that's all good. I think the real issue is the confidence level of individuals and institutions in regional banks, and what does that do longer term, and how does that affect the solvency and the business model of the large banks? Because in 2008, it was about the large banks and being too big to fail, et cetera. Having the competition of these flexible regional banks was good for everybody, in my view. And so how does this play out? I don't think anybody really knows, but I don't think it's anything like the scale of what happened in 2008.
I mean, how in your practice over the last week plus have you felt the effect of the events at SVB?
Well, I would say it certainly caused a lot of people to take a hard look at where their money was. If they were borrowing money, was SVB in their credit facility, and were they going to have the ability to close a deal? But in general, because everything happened so quickly and because depositors were made whole, I think the fallout was somewhat limited, other than just creating a crisis of confidence and people wondering, well, who's next, what's going to happen next. I think the bigger issue, frankly, and it's not as relevant to the kinds of companies that I represent, who are typically large public companies, but there is an issue about what's going to happen with the venture debt market. You know, startups have used this basically low-cost lending solution to top up their balance sheets between equity funding rounds for years. You know, it's become a part of their toolkit. And banks like SVB have also been providing bridge financing to venture capital firms, which again allows them to fund their investments before making capital calls to their LPs. And I just think it's unlikely that a larger bank would be willing or even able to fill the void left by SVB in this market, because SVB lent based on relationships, lent based on trust, in a way that a large bank probably would not. And it seems like the US government is trying to find a large bank to take over the assets. Shorter term, I think the downfall of SVB increases the likelihood that there's going to be down rounds, which a lot of companies have tried to hold off on, and then possibly distressed M&A exits in the next 6 to 9 months, because this lifeline isn't going to be there. But I think longer term, the loss of a supportive institution like SVB is likely to make life much harder for startups. But outside of that, I don't think it's going to have a huge effect on M&A beyond the question of who else is going to fail and how is that going to affect the ability for people to close their deals if they're lending into transactions.
And of course, in the last 15 years, SVB is implementing this strategy in a period of interest rates that are both very low and very stable. That's a much harder strategy to implement if you have interest rate volatility and generally higher interest rates.
Absolutely. And I think, as I was saying earlier, there was just free money basically washing into the system everywhere. And the fact that SVB's deposits, I want to say the statistic is that they doubled or something, you know, within the span of a year and a half. I don't think we're ever going to see a period like that again in the next 10 years or so. And in some ways, the idiosyncrasies of the pandemic and everything that came with it will unlikely to be repeated. But it's a lesson that everybody needs to learn, is that beyond the $250,000 it's insured, things can be risky. And I think most companies, most people, including some very large public companies, put a lot of money into Silicon Valley Bank and just based on the trust and the assumption that nothing like this would ever happen. So I think people are a little bit more cautious and will start to think about having multiple different banks, finding ways to reduce their exposure to any one institution. And I think that's a good thing.
And sticking with financial issues, obviously lending markets have become tighter, interest rates are higher. How has that affected tech M&A, a field in which over the last 5 or 10 years, private equity sponsors have become a massively larger part of the market?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. And it's no secret that private equity sponsors have been binging on software companies in particular for a number of years now. And when you look at the take private data, over the last several years, a significant proportion of those deals have been in the tech sector. So with names like Citrix, McAfee, Proofpoint, Zendesk. I mean, there's a very large deals being done. I think private equity sponsors are now going to start focusing on sub $5 billion take privates and portfolio company bolt-ons. And although, you know, debt financing does still remain available, particularly for direct lending platforms, the costs have just risen substantially and the terms are becoming more challenging. And what I've been seeing is sponsors are looking at creative ways to circumvent, you know, these challenging market conditions. A few examples are what the so-called portable capital structures. So selling sponsors basically trying to roll over their existing debt, which is obviously much more favorable than the terms that they can get today. And the ways they've been looking at implementing that strategy is, you know, paying for a change of control waiver, doing a continuation fund transaction with minority investments from other sponsors, or just selling a minority interest in the hopes of later selling a larger stake. Another development I'm seeing is that sponsors are doing 100% equity commitments with no debt financing in deals, hoping that they can back leverage it in the future when financing is available on better terms. We've also seen increased club deals and joint bids. And then another thing that I recently heard about is that especially larger funds are using their fund level credit facility to warehouse the debt until market conditions improve. And so they basically draw down on their fund facility to provide the leverage in their acquisitions. And then again, hope that things change in the near future and they can move the debt down to the portfolio company level.
What's the perspective on direct lending? Is the sense that direct lending is going to become a larger and larger piece of the overall leveraged finance market? Or is the sense that there are some structural limitations to direct lending that may ensure that it remains more a feature of, say, sub $5 billion deals than of the really big transactions?
Yeah, so there's obviously limits based on the size of the balance sheets of the direct lenders. You know, the advantage is that they're usually very flexible and can move quickly, but they often require tighter covenants and a little bit worse terms for the borrower than you see in the syndicated lending market. And there is a lot of dry powder out there, and there are going to be deals because people need to put money to work. And so I think the longer term direct lending certainly has a place in the constellation of options for sponsors, but I don't think it's going to be like the dominant form of financing anytime soon, just because people are very creative, as I was saying, and they will find ways to leverage the more traditional syndicated lending markets.
And then shifting gears a little bit, obviously, under the Biden administration, there's been a much more vigorous approach to antitrust. How has that affected your job as an M&A lawyer and how you negotiate deals and draft merger agreements?
Yeah, we've seen some significant policy changes under the Biden administration. And I do think that's forced people to rethink some of the ways they allocate antitrust risk in M&A deals. I'm seeing requests for larger breakup fees, longer drop dead dates, because people want to preserve the threat that they will litigate if the agencies aren't willing to negotiate on reasonable terms. I think there's a new playbook that I've seen developing called Fix It First. So basically, it allows a party to pursue divestitures earlier in the process, and then they defend them litigation if necessary. So a good example of this is the United Health Change Healthcare deal. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but United's largest commercial health insurer in the US and Change is a healthcare tech company that sold products and solutions used by, you know, United's competitors, basically. And to mitigate potential competitive overlaps, the parties agreed to divest certain assets to TPG Capital. The DOJ filed a lawsuit to try to block the deal, but they lost at trial. And, you know, basically the judge vindicated this fix it first strategy. Another benefit of pursuing divestitures on your own, as opposed to waiting until you can talk to the agencies, is that if you take the fix it first approach and you go to litigation and you win, then it reduces the likelihood that you're ever going to have to enter into a consent decree as a condition to receiving antitrust approval. And one of the innovations, sort of a back to the future moment, is that the agencies have been using consent decrees to impose notice or consent requirements that can limit future M&A deals by the buyer, and so-called prior approval regimes that were used before the 1990s and came back, you know, last year. And I think that avoiding a potential prior approval arrangement with the FTC or the DOJ has a lot of value. And so people are more focused on the litigation possibility than they are on hell or high water covenants, because it's possible that regardless of what the buyer proposes, it may not be accepted, since the FTC and the DOJ leadership have been increasingly disfavoring structural remedies.
And then talk a little bit about ChatGPT and how that may change the day-to-day job of being an M&A lawyer.
Sure. So maybe I'll just start with a famous quote. Mark Andreessen, he's a famous venture capitalist in 2011. He said, "Software is eating the world." And in January of this year, he said, "We're entering an AI-powered golden age." And he said something about it being like world historical. I mean, he was clearly right in 2011, and I think he's right now. So ChatGPT is within the category of something called generative AI, and it uses a large language model. What's interesting is it came out last fall, and then it became much more publicly adopted by a lot of people, and people started to see how powerful it really was, to the point where there were headlines of Google and other companies accelerating their own AI platforms and finding ways to put chatbots to use, because Microsoft was being an existential threat by getting huge investment in OpenAI. So OpenAI actually just released something called GPT-4, which is apparently much more sophisticated than ChatGPT. Just as an example, GPT-4 scored in the 90th percentile on the uniform bar exam that New York administers to law students.
passing on the New York bar exam?
I think that's passing. I mean, by comparison, ChatGPT scored in the 10th percentile. So just think about the increase. So
about 6 months.
Exactly. And so things are going to continue to iterate. And we're basically in the middle of an AI arms race between Microsoft, Google, and other large tech companies. I think this technology is likely to revolutionize writing, design, research, coding. But of course, I don't want to oversell it. You know, social media is flooded with examples of questions that ChatGPT failed to answer correctly. And I don't know if you know this, but the mistakes are now often referred to as hallucinations because the answers are just so strange.
Right.
But notwithstanding the bugs and the strange hallucinations, I think in the years to come, generative AI is going to affect billions of knowledge workers, including lawyers, and it's going to drive new use cases that we can't even think of today. And in particular, for the practice of law, I think these tools are going to eventually be able to draft contracts quickly and accurately, do a lot of heavy lifting and due diligence, answer questions that would otherwise require a lot of legal research, and optimize knowledge management. And anytime there's changes like that, there's a lot of anxiety about what does that mean for people's jobs. I think it's going to push M&A lawyers and other lawyers further up the value chain, where they really are providing more of an advice-based model as opposed to a review 100 contracts and tell me if there's a change of control provision. And in the long run, I think that's going to be a good development, because it's going to create more efficiencies, more speed, and will create more job satisfaction for people who are doing what is a challenging job at times.
In the almost 15 years you've been practicing law, how much has the practice changed because of the incorporation of a technology that makes tasks that would once have been viewed as central to the services a law firm provides to clients, a task that can be automated or can be done with massively less lawyer time than would have been the case 15 years ago, 20 years ago? I mean, certainly sure. You think of discovery as a classic example.
In my mind, that was the first thing I thought of, was e-discovery. You know, I think that did have a very large impact. That it really hasn't filtered over into the M&A side yet, but I do think large language model based AI tools are going to eventually find use cases on transactions that M&A lawyers will be dealing with. To be honest, other than the introduction of the iPhone and the proliferation of Zoom and online data rooms, the day-to-day hasn't changed significantly, but I think we're on the precipice of big changes. Maybe in the next 5 years, we're going to be at a point where the tools that are currently available will start to scale in their capabilities exponentially.
Right.
And when I was a first-year associate, a lot of your day-to-day was doing diligence and Now you're going to be able to just upload the contents of a data room through an API to some service. That service will tell you and extract all the provisions that are relevant. And then you just click the box and say yes or no. Yeah, that's a problem or it's not. And so the fact that we're not quite there yet doesn't mean that we won't get there. But I don't think that the current technology is as revolutionary. To take a Terminator reference, since we're talking about Schwarzenegger earlier, you know, we're not at Skynet yet, but maybe we will be in the future.
So what do you think law firms will look like in 10 years?
Yes, I don't think they're going to look a lot different. I just think that you're not going to have, as you probably know, you know, law firms are sort of a pyramid model. There are fewer partners and associates. I think instead of being a pyramid with a very wide base, I think the bottom of the pyramid will become a little bit narrower, just because you're not going to need as many people to do the tasks that you do now. But I think practice of law, it's a relationship business. It's a business based on expertise and knowledge and advice and trust. And those things are not going to change based on AI tools. But the pace at which we do deals will continue to increase. When I look back at how long it took to do basic things when I first started in 2008 versus how quickly you can do them now, I mean, it is substantially faster. You know, deals just move more quickly. And I understand that. In the 10 years before I started, you know, when email became a thing that people used in their jobs, when people didn't have to physically drop stuff off at courts, that created an effect that increased the pace of the practice of law. And so I think we're going to continue to see things move more quickly, become more efficient, and then expectations will scale up along with that from clients.
That has obvious implications for the lawyer quality of life, which have become really pressing since the start of the pandemic. But that raises two other issues. One, implications for lawyers' quality of life. But then secondly, the issue of whether that ability to complete a transaction very quickly is in fact good for the parties themselves.
Yeah. Well, on the quality of life side, I think it will improve the quality of life because it will allow somebody to, it's going to sound crazy, but like, you know, push a button and generate a contract, or perhaps click a few boxes and fill in a few things and generate a contract in a way that now could take 20 hours or 30 hours. That contract is still going to have to be reviewed by somebody. It's still going to be negotiated. There's not going to be a complete obliteration of the manual process of negotiating and drafting. But I think the starting point that people start from will be vastly improved and more efficient. But in terms of the actual number of deals, there's still 24 hours in a day. So there are some limits. But I think the bigger question is, how do we train younger lawyers? How do we have them build those foundational skills that they're acquiring now by just repetition of things when there are less of them? We have less opportunities to promote people to partner. And so I think the pipeline issue is something that a lot of firms will have to start thinking about very carefully.
And then finally, Chris, tell us a little bit about what you do outside of work.
Sure. So I'm in the Bay Area, as we've mentioned many times. I love to spend time outdoors whenever I can. So whether that's hiking in Yosemite or Point Reyes, which is one of my favorites, or snowboarding in Lake Tahoe. I love to go to Napa Valley. It's just so beautiful there. And of course, it's very close by. So I go there all the time. And I also ride my motorcycle along the coast. There's just some amazing, you know, windy roads on Highway 1 that if you're a motorcycle rider, there are very few places like it. And the natural beauty is just amazing. And then sticking to the Napa Valley topic, you know, I really love wine. It's something that allows me to get a lot of intellectual stimulation and quench my thirst for knowledge or something that's not M&A related. And I'm really loving right now Pinot Noirs from the Sonoma coast and from an appellation in Santa Barbara called Santa Rita Hills.
Do you have a favorite producer or a couple of favorite producers?
I do. Yeah. So in the Sonoma coast, Occidental is great. Another one's called RAEN. It's a R-A-E-N. It's an acronym. And then down in Santa Barbara, a producer called Domaine de la Cote has been my favorite for years, and they produce excellent wines.
Awesome. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.